cultivating the relationship is different than cultivating the partnership.
Sure.
So I want to be distinction on that. So cultivating the relationship is very simple. Reciprocal vulnerability. There is no trust without vulnerability, and vulnerability has to be reciprocal. Think about your best friend that, or somebody you've known for, I don't know, 5 or 10 years, who is like, you trust them entirely. You trust them with your life.
Hmm.
Now think about someone else you know, you've known for about the same amount of time, and they're merely an acquaintance. What's the difference? It's not time, because we just erase that.
Yep.
It's reciprocal vulnerability. It's that you were able to show up with your shit, and they can show up with theirs, and neither of you are willing to use it against each other. You're willing to be there for each other. So reciprocal vulnerability is how we build trust.
This is the Partnership Playbook, a podcast helping sales and marketing leaders secure high-value partnerships that finally unlock business growth and reclaim time. I'm your coach, Phil Hayes Sinclair. Welcome to the show.
Folks, we're here talking to Dov this morning, and this is a gentleman who you'll see in the introduction has had quite a career. He's been influencing and sharing his knowledge with audiences for a great amount of time. And I am very, very fascinated to dive into his thinking on leadership, in particular, the way emotional intelligence plays a role in leadership and in partnership. So, Dov, thank you for making time. It's great to see you.
It's my pleasure, Phil. It's always a pleasure and honor. I'm looking forward to being of service in whatever way I can.
I appreciate it. Well, look, let's get the fundamentals down. Let's introduce you. What mission are you on, and what has brought you to that mission?
There are levels to that question. So the first level of that question is the broad spectrum, which is I'm here to impact the lives of those people whose names I will never know and who will never know my name. So it's not about the rounds of applause in the moment or, ooh, you're Dov Barron, but really about leaving, creating a legacy, a ripple that has got nothing to do with my name or my, quote, fame, whatever the hell that means, but rather about creating positive impact. So that's at the first level of it. At the second level of it is, as you know, my work privately is mentoring and guiding high-profile individuals who are athletes, entertainers, politicians, high-level CEOs, those kinds of people. And in many ways, that kind of started out with this understanding that I learned from all my research, which is that I wanted to be a father to men. I realized how desperate men were for a father. And even if you had a good dad, there's still something missing there.
Yeah.
Simply because it's your dad. So not because he did a bad job, but there is something there that we all need, that hand on the shoulder, I'm proud of your son, even when we're 70 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And hand on the shoulder, you're screwing up, kid. I love you, but you got to get your shit together.
Hmm.
And I think we all need that. And I don't know that we can often hear that from our own fathers.
What is it that drew you to that thinking and wanting to play that role?
That's easy. I didn't have a dad. I mean, it comes from the fact that my own father buggered off when I was 7.
Hmm.
So I didn't really have a dad. And then I had a stepdad who was... trying to think of politically correct, there isn't one, who was a pedophile, who was a misogynistic ass, so there was nothing to learn about having a dad from him. And I had a grandfather who was narcissistic and extremely damaging, so I didn't have any really great men around me. And instead of that sort of, I went out into the world looking for dads and met a lot of guys who just didn't own their own heart. They didn't own their own soul and realized. Now, remember, I'm in my 60s. So, you know, this is not recently, toxic masculine. No, This is back in the 60s and the 70s, and I'm recognizing there's no men.
Mm.
I became a Jungian therapist and started studying Jungian archetypes and started to understand we need fathers. We need that. And it's not just men who need it, it's women too, but that needing that and understanding that that was what was compelling me to, while studying psychology and quantum physics and metaphysics and neurosciences and all the other things that I was studying and politics, it was like there's a fatherly edge to that that's different than authority.
Mm. When we think about emotional intelligence and we think about, you know, hopefully we've gone through our formative years with a really reasonably good set of people that can help form that out. But at some point, you move out into the world, and as you say, there is not really the signal or the guide to help you round that out. What is it about men in particular, and we'll use this as the frame for much of this conversation, what is it about men and what are they looking for in order to round themselves out? Because the people that you would deal with most days in your coaching practice, the CEOs, the politicians, the people who are living a relatively senior and lonely, I would imagine, professional existence where there's not that many places to bounce ideas from and to sort of get a good bearing on what and how to think about things. How is it that they find you and come to you, and what is it that you're helping them do at that level, that high level of their careers?
That's layered. So let's go through the layers. First of all, we like to assume these people are lonely, and to a degree that is true. And it's not, but it's not true for the reasons we often think of. The reason it's true is because the more successful you become, the more transactional things become. And what I mean by that is this, and I gave this example to a very powerful individual I was working with last week, and he's like, you know, I have a very small circle of friends because everybody who interacts with me is transactional because they know my power and my influence, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, no, that's not true. And he's like, yeah, it is. That's my experience. And I go, no, it's not true. It's the lens you're looking through. And he goes, what do you mean? I said, can you remember when you weren't successful? And he goes, yeah. I said, can you remember being in your 20s or maybe even early 30s? And he goes, yeah. I said, were you ambitious? And he goes, very, very, very ambitious. I said, okay. And when you met somebody who had power and influence, there is a level of you want to get something, right? And he goes, yeah. I said, well, isn't that everybody who you're also meeting now? Aren't they reflecting that to you? And he goes, yeah. And I said, now, here's the other thing. You may see them only as transactional, and that's the problem. They are transactional, no doubt about that, but you're seeing them only as transactional, and that's the problem. And he goes, well, what do you mean? I said, if you can remember back to when you were in your late 20s and early 30s, yes, you were ambitious, and you were aspiring, and you were wanting something. But let me ask you, didn't you want to know that person? And he said, yeah. And I said, so why were you coming across as transactional? And he goes, I don't know. I said, think about somebody you met. And he gave me an example. I said, and you wanted to know that person. He said, yeah. I said, but you came across as transactional. What was the difference? He goes, I guess I just was uncomfortable. I was nervous. I go, that's everybody you're dealing with.
Mm.
Everybody who fronts up to you enters the room feeling intimidated by your success. And then they come across as transactional out of their nervousness. I said, and I got a great example of it last week that a friend of mine said, I met this other person, right? And they said, you totally intimidated the shit out of them, Dove. And I said, really? And they go, yeah, for 20 minutes. Because I was talking to other people and they were standing by. And then this person interacted with me and my friend said, and then they totally changed their mind. Because they were listening to me talk to this group of people and I was giving guidance and it was knowledgeable and it was insightful and it was intimidating and my personality, my prowess. But when they spoke to me, instead of me going, oh, let me guide you, I just went, hey, how are you? Where are you from? What's going on? And they said, they suddenly realized I was very human. So I understood, and this is what I've always understood, is that everybody is nervous when they meet somebody who appears to be on a different level than them. And instead, we, if we're on the upper level, we have a responsibility to reach down and be human. That is emotional intelligence in action. That's emotional maturity, not emotional intelligence. Emotional intelligence is crap you're reading a book. Emotional maturity is putting that in action, reaching down and saying, hey, how you doing? What's going on? That's a wicked tie you got on. Or what a great haircut. Or funky shoes, dude. Or where are you from? You've got a weird accent. A conversational piece that's not, well, look at me. I'm the bee's knees and you should pay attention to me. That's the distinction.
When you think about all of the people you've influenced in your career and the way you've forged partnerships with them, whether it be one-on-one, one-to-many, that starting point you've just described, connection, a level of trust, a level of exchange, fundamental human things that need to happen. What is your next step after that? If you've met someone for the first time and you've thought, actually, there is potential here for a really fantastic relationship, what are the next steps or the playbook you use to try and cultivate that relationship?
Well, cultivating the relationship is different than cultivating the partnership.
Sure.
So I want to be distinction on that. So cultivating the relationship is very simple. Reciprocal vulnerability. There is no trust without vulnerability, and vulnerability has to be reciprocal. Think about your best friend or somebody you've known for, I don't know, 5 or 10 years, who is like you trust them entirely. You trust them with your life. Now think about someone else you know, you've known for about the same amount of time, and they're merely an acquaintance. What's the difference? It's not time, because we just erased that.
Yep.
It's reciprocal vulnerability. It's that you were able to show up with your shit and they can show up with theirs, and neither of you are willing to use it against each other. You're willing to be there for each other. So reciprocal vulnerability is how we build trust. Then if I see in that okay, I feel this bond of trust. When I'm not jumping into a partnership with anybody until I have that. Once I have that, then it's like, okay, so here's what you do. And here's what I do. Now, remember, I'm seeing the potential. And I say, how do you think we should work together? What do you think we can do together? Not here's my idea. What do you see? Because I want to put that on them. And I'll tell you why. May I tell you a little story about this?
Please. Let's have it.
I was in Vegas like 15, 20 years ago. And, you know, I've spoken all over the world and have done for 40 years. And this lady I got to meet said, I want to be a speaker. Will you help me? And I said, sure. To a degree, we'll find out. Let's start out. She goes, okay. I said, here's the email address to talk to my person who does my coordinating, and I'll give you 30 minutes and we'll start with that. And she said, okay, great. So she books it. And later on, we're on a Skype call. And I said, so she goes, yeah, I really want to be a speaker. I said, that's great. She goes, what's your best advice? I said, oh, okay. Shower. It's a very good idea to shower. So she starts to laugh, right? She thinks I'm cracking a joke. And she goes, oh, okay, funny. What else do you recommend? I said, definitely wear deodorant. Gets very hot on stage. Now she's getting huffy. She goes, no, I'm trying to be serious here, Dove. Will you help me? And I said, I told you I would help you. She goes, well, why are you giving me these answers? I go, because you haven't asked me anything yet. It's not my job to tell you what you need. You have to show up. If you're going to value my input, you better value your questions.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you're taking me for granted, and I'm not here to serve up to you what you think you should get. That's entitlement. Come back when you're not entitled, right? She was pissed off, understandably, because I was very direct. Mm-hmm. I saw her at an event in LA about 2 years later, and I just sort of saw her at the corner of my eye, and she came over to me with her friend, and she goes, this guy changed my life. I didn't even know who she was. I didn't recognize her.
Mm.
And I said, what? And she goes, yeah. And then she went through the story and she goes, I changed the way I approach everybody and everything from that point on, that I will not show up entitled. If you show up into a partnership conversation entitled, you're dead in the water.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm not going to tell you what you need to know. I want to find out what it is you're offering. Do you have any value? Because if you don't, then you're acting in an entitled transactional manner, and I have no interest in having those kinds of relationships, let alone partnerships.
Yeah. When you have found the best partnership that you can think of, the one that is in your mind the exemplar, and we break that down, was that a long-term partnership or was that a shorter-term partnership? And the reason I ask is that there is a view generally that when you pair two words, strategic and partnership, people think it has to last forever. And that's obviously not true. When you think about the best ones you've been part of,
mm-hmm.
long or short?
I've had very good short ones. But that was the intention going in on both sides.
Exactly. Exactly, right? So when we think about this, people will say to us, when we're coaching, I should say, they will say to us, you know, we have a very strong understanding of what the partnership is. And I said, prove it. So we've had many conversations. Okay. Is it on paper somewhere? That intention? No. We have a memorandum of understanding. Okay. What we try to find in people is an ability for them to put on paper why this makes sense. Why does a partnership make sense so we're not taking each other's time for granted? And it's a very simple document. We're not going to go into it now. But the thing is, I'm curious about when somebody comes to you and says, I would like to do business with you. You've gone through the trust steps. You've got a level of comfort. That exchange of vulnerability has been happening. You feel as though that's there. How quickly does a material win have to present itself in order for you to go, my hunch has been confirmed. This is something that we should continue building out. Is there a mental model you've got for that, or is there something that you sort of wait to see it play out?
No. I mean, I've had relationships. I actually was on one this morning at 7 a.m., with somebody I met 9 years ago. I had met him like this over, you know, online 9 years ago. 2 weeks later, he was sending me a note that he was in Vegas. He lives in Europe. And I said, I'm off for the next couple of days. I'm going to fly to Vegas, come meet you. So I flew to Vegas and actually met him and another guy I knew this way. Both of those guys I've had, like, I call them very close friends.
Mm.
Both of them I have the intention of partnership. They have a very strong intention of partnership. I have no problem with the fact that it's not happened yet.
Mm.
None at all. Because the friendship is the priority. And I serve them in helping them, and they serve me in helping me with thinking about how to approach my business more. The business is not the priority. The relationship is always the priority. And I tell this to leaders all the time.
Correct.
The relationship is the priority. The partnership will come from that. It might not be today. It might not be 10 years from now. But that level of trust will be so foundational that if I turn to my friend and say, hey, Tone, this is what I'm doing. Can you jump on a plane? Tony will jump on a plane.
Mm-hmm. 100%.
And vice versa.
Yep.
Right? So it's, for me, it doesn't have a timeline. I know that for a lot of people who are very, they're more sort of bottom line thinking than I am around that. I'm definitely top line relationship thinking that builds business. And so as a result, you know, I've got a beautiful endorsement as an example from Jay Abraham, who you probably know from, who's like a marketing guru.
Mm-hmm.
And I've got it was a 17-minute endorsement from him that I had to cut down, right? Where he says, I don't do endorsements. Certainly not for people who can guide you the way that Dove can, because in some ways we're kind of a crossover, and he's kind of my competition. And he gives me this beautiful endorsement. That's relationship.
Yeah, 100%. I want to talk more about the emotional source code and the way that you've developed that over time. Our research sort of also showed up prior to that, an accident that you had free climbing. And I just want to touch on that for a minute, because when I read it on paper, I had a similar, not a similar, but not too far away an experience like that, which frightened me to the core. And I'm wondering, and just for people who don't know this story, and perhaps you can build this out if I've got this incorrect, 1990, free climbing, fell, broke a lot of your body, recovered, obviously, and have moved through life. Tell me about what that moment was, what it meant for you in terms of reframing your view on life, and why did that lead you down the path you're at now? And I hope there's a connection point between that event and the emotional source code work that you've drafted and brought to the world. If I've got that wrong, let me know. But it felt to me like there is a thread between those two points.
Absolutely. So you had a near-death experience, is that correct?
Correct.
Right. So one of the things about a near-death experience, as you said, you know, I was free climbing in British Columbia, Canada, and fell approximately 120 feet, maximum velocity, and landed mostly on my face. So I've had 12 reconstructive surgeries. And obviously they were able to put my face back together. But the event is never the event. And this is what I try and tell everybody. And you'll definitely get this, Phil, because you've been through it. After I fell, when people would say to me, "How you doing?" I've got my jaw wired closed, okay? I've fallen in June, and in November, like a lunatic, I'm bungee jumping 140 feet. Because in my language, I'm abyssal meshuggah, which means I'm a little crazy. I was a full-blown adrenaline junkie. And people say, you know, now they say, "Oh, that event must have changed your life." And I'm like, "No, it didn't." And they go, "Really?" I'm like, "No, it made me worse." And they go, "What do you mean?" It embedded me in my ego. When people would say to me, "How you doing?" I would say through the wires, "I'm great. I'm coming back." Because I bought this bullshit idea from my childhood that resilience was what mattered most. Resilience is stupid. Dumb resilience is what I call it. Get knocked down 8 times, get up 9. Then you're an idiot. Get knocked down once, stay on your ass and work out why you're there so you don't have to go down 2, 3, 4, 9 times, which was my case. I fell 4 times. That mountaintop fall was my 4th fall. I fell off Bluff Knoll in Western Australia at 70 feet and tumbled down the entire... What did I do? Well, yeah, it's fine. Because I'm resilient. It's nonsense. You don't want to be resilient. You want to be anti-fragile, which means work out why you were there so you can grow and develop from that. That's a vastly different thing. So when I fell, it didn't change me. It embedded me in my ego. Because I'm this ghetto kid. I've been a martial artist. I've been a boxer. I've been a bodybuilder. I've owned businesses on 3 continents. I've led some of the most powerful people in the world. You're not going to get me down. Stupid. So on a Saturday night, my friends would take me out because I was broken, and they would try and cheer me up. And I'd go out on these Saturday nights and have this big sort of smiley face and, you know, again, "I'm great, I'm coming back." And I'd fake laughing, I'd fake having a good time, and I'd come home miserable and depressed. And I just was so emotionally and mentally and psychologically beat up. And then one of the Saturday nights, I went out with the lads, and I actually laughed, and it was real. I had a good time. And my mate Harold dropped me off at the back, and as he dropped me off, I'm walking down the back path to my house, and I'm smiling to myself, thinking, "I am coming back. I had a good time tonight. I've got this sort of glimmer of hope." I open the back door, and the light from outside floods the kitchen floor, and across the kitchen floor, there's garbage everywhere. there's kitty litter, there's meat packaging, there's empty coffee grinds, and it stinks. And I've gone from that moment, a flicker of hope, to pure, unadulterated rage. Not anger, rage. Like, my head's exploded. And I start walking through the house, stomping around, looking for the culprit who I feel like I want to kill. And I get into the living room, and there's the culprit on the couch, all curled up and all comfy. And I raise my hand to strike, but I'm not a violent person. So immediately some part of my brain clicks in and goes, that's not who you are. So I stop. And instead, I scoop my cat up into my arms and pull him close to me. And he's cold. And he's stiff. And he's dead. He had a distemper attack, and that's why he'd torn up the kitchen and then died on the couch. And I fell to my knees, and I began to weep. And I was only there probably 2 minutes when I realized I'm not crying for Tough. That was the name of the cat. I'm not crying for the death of the cat. I'm crying for the loss of me. Who I'd been, that ego sense of who I was, had to die. And it took that fall for me to realize that, but not the fall, but the 9 months after, a full gestation period after of depression, and then another 9 months from that moment on of going, okay, why am I here? Why am I, and beginning to deeply dig into finding my purpose. And now, as I said earlier, my background is that I started out studying metaphysical studies, Vedanta, Taoism, Buddhism, Gnostic and Coptic Christianity, Kabbalah, all these different religions. Then I became a Jungian psychologist, started studying all that. Then I started studied quantum physics because I'm a polymath. I study a bunch of different things while studying martial arts and boxing and running businesses, doing all those things. So I started studying quantum physics and then neuroscience in the very early days of neuroscience in like 81 and 82 and 83. And then it was a form of biohacking and then stumbled into quantum physics. And it was all that coming together in that 9 month period where I realized I've been sort of skirting around the edge of understanding this emotional code that we all carry around that is entirely subjective, but is tied into a collective. And I was like, this is really interesting. Started looking at that in quantum fields and how it worked. And so that was the foundation. I'd done all the work in the 20 years before that fall, but I'd not been able to piece it together because my ego was in the way.
Mm.
But that fall had shattered that open. And as I say to people all the time, when Humpty Dumpty falls down, you're not supposed to put him back together again. We tried to do that. I did for the first three of the four falls. You're supposed to make scrambled eggs. You're supposed to find out what else is in there that's different. And so in that process, it broke open my identity. So as I said, my body got shattered. My ego got shattered. My body got put back together, but my identity didn't. I tried my best to, but it wasn't going to work. And it's from there that I realized deeply this need to be a father to myself, to really give that to me, not in some theoretical way, but in a really deep sense, that I realized that many of the people I'd worked with before I fell were needing that thing, and then starting looking at this code and how I could recognize that code at five separate levels within an individual, and in my case, within organizations and even nations, because I've written emotional source codes for America, I did one for England, I did one on Vladimir Putin when he invaded Ukraine, I did one on Donald Trump in 2015 and said why he would win, you know, so it's you understand those emotional source codes, you understand what drives the person, the organization, or even the nation.
Can we double tap on that for a minute? What is, if somebody was to experience that as a leader, the development of a source code? Mm-hmm. Their emotional source code. Can you walk that through for me?
So it's understanding at a primary level that between 0 and 7, whether you remember that period or not, most of us don't, but even if you don't, you are impacted by everything that's going on around you. So the simplest way to think of this is this. When you come into the world, human beings are pretty useless, right? So, you know, a giraffe or an elephant sort of falls out and stumbles its way out of the sack, and then right there it's eating its own food and walking around, doing its own thing, right?
Yep.
Human beings, we're bloody useless. You know, we're still living in our mother's basement at 30. Like, what the hell's going on? We've not really got our shit together. So we're very dependent. And because of that, when you enter into the world, mom and dad, this is, again, primal psychology and Jungian stuff, mom and dad are the god and goddess. They know why the grass is green, why the sky is blue. They tell you to eat when you're not hungry. They tell you to stop eating when you are hungry. They make you get up when you're tired. They make you go to bed when you're not tired. They have all the power. Mm. And because they have all the power, they are right. Now think about this. This is psychological. They are right. Now, you're not standing on the edge of your crib, holding onto the edge of the crib, while mom and dad are fighting about money, going, you know, these people really need some therapy. You're not doing that. You're going, oh, this is how the world works, right? This is how the world works. It's not rationale. It's going in directly in. You're in a deep delta state, and it's like deep hypnotic state, particularly for the first 4, but certainly for the first 7 years. And that stuff's just going in, and it tells you this is what reality is. So, you know, I don't understand why I have money problems. Did your mom and dad have money problems? Yeah. Okay. That's part of your emotional source code. Yeah. Why do I always pick women who are? Why do I always pick men who are? Look at the emotional source code. You'll find it. You know, what is your belief about? So here's the thing. I'll walk you through the code. Is that okay?
Do it.
Right. So somebody comes, let's say you come to me and you say, Dov, I really want to change this behavior. It's a shitty behavior. It's impacting my parenting. It's impacting my romantic relationship with my partner. And it's also shows up in other areas. I go, okay. So I said, well, go talk to this person over here. They're a behavioralist. And you go, you come back a year later, you go, I did all the work with them and it did change the behavior, but not really. And I go, well, have you looked at the beliefs and the values that established that behavior? No, we never did that. Oh, okay. So go look at this person. This person will help you with the beliefs and the values. We'll do some values elicitation. That's deeper work, right? Yeah. Okay, yeah. So I've worked on my values, Dove, and it's really good. And he still didn't behave. Yep. I don't understand. Why am I doing that? I know it's against my values. It's not even aligned with my beliefs. Well, what's your identity? Well, I'm a CEO. I'm a business person. I'm a PhD. I'm a something. I'm a Christian. I'm a Jew. I am. That's identity. Is it yours? What do you mean? Is it mine? Well, what's your religion, Phil? And you go, well, I'm Christian. I'm not saying that you are. I'm making it up, right?
Yep.
I'm Christian. And my question is, why? Well, I go to church on Sunday. Well, if I park my Ferrari in, I park my Ford in a Ferrari garage on a Sunday, does that make my car a Ferrari? No. Well, if you park your ass in the church on Sunday, does that make you a Christian? No. Well, why are you a Christian? Well, I believe in John 3:16. Okay, cool. Why? Well, I was brought up in a Christian faith and my mom and dad are Christian. Oh, so it's not yours. I'm not trying to talk you out of your faith, but I'm trying to find out if it's yours. What do you mean? Oh, so we've never questioned the identity. That identity has got many levels to it, and it's also got a disenfranchised section to it. So the disenfranchised part is the part that was not allowed if you were to be in this tribe called your family or your greater family or your community of Christians or Jews or Muslims or Hindus or Sikhs or whatever it might be. You can't be that. You can't be gay and be a Muslim, so I'll repress my gay. Right? So you can't. So there's all kinds of mechanisms around building this identity and disenfranchising parts of ourselves. The problem is your identity is not all positive. It's in order to fit in, because human beings need to belong, and we trade belonging for fitting in. So how we fit in is the problem, because we disenfranchise things to fit in. So I'll take out my earrings and I shave my beard and I won't do this, or I won't wear a dress even though I've got testicles, even though I want to wear a dress, because it doesn't fit in with this company. So we start fitting in and we start repressing ourselves. Well, why did we do that? Because we gave life meaning based on the original environment we were in, which is where we got our emotional source code. Once we understand that, it's like, oh, okay, it becomes clear. So that's why I can do it for a nation. That's why I can do it for individuals in ways that are like, when people, you can, by the way, you can go to DovBaron.com, click on the red box when it pops up, and it'll give you the emotional source code of Vladimir Putin. And people are like, wow, I never knew that about him. I never understood that. I did a lot of time and a lot of research to develop that. It's what I do. But as a result of that, you now see him rather than seeing him as a megalomaniac who's trying to take over the world. I'm not saying that's not true either, but it's not exclusively true. There's more to the picture. And we like to see people as these single-faceted beings, and nobody is. We are multifaceted beings. You can say, well, I'm a very analytical person. Bullshit. No, you're not. And they go, why? Neuroscientifically, I can prove that you're emotional first. Mm. Well, but I value rational. I understand. You can value it, but you can't say that's who you are. You're not a thing. You're multiple things. So when I met my wife and we started to fall in love, I said, are you monogamous? And she said, of course. And I said, why of course? Why are you saying of course? Well, I don't fool around. I didn't say that. I asked you if you're monogamous. She goes, are you not? And I said, I am. By choice. She says, what do you mean? I said, I used to be monogamous by obligation. Because my father was a philanderer, and so I didn't want to be like him, so I was monogamous to not be like him. I had to choose to be monogamous, and said, so here's the deal. You and I, this is my agreement to you. She goes, what? I said, you're allowed to sleep with anybody you want. She goes, really? I don't want that. I said, no, but I want you to understand, I have no control over that. So you're free to sleep with anybody you want. There's a consequence, though, and that is that I won't be in the relationship. It's okay. I have no control over you. And I'm free to sleep with anybody I want, but I know the consequences at the end of the relationship. And personally, I'm not willing to trade that, but it's a choice rather than an obligation in every single moment. So what does that mean? It means that if I see a beautiful woman, you know, we've all got our hotties, right? You've got somebody you look at and you go, ooh, delicious. Whether you're a man or a woman, doesn't matter. You've got somebody you look at. Mine's Selma Hayek, right?
And good I always choice.
Good yeah. choice, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. And I said, you know, and the analogy I give is if I walk into my bedroom and Selma Hayek's laid on the bed, naked, right? And she's reeling around. She goes, hey, Dove, come on over. I said, I got to be honest. I'm going to take in the view for a couple of seconds. Because I'm a human being and I'm a man. And then I'm going to say, thank you, Selma. You need to get your clothes on because I'm going to go in the other room and I'll wait for you. I'm married and I'm happily married and I don't want to do this. I desire to do this, but I don't want to do this. Because I understand I'm not run by my desire, but I can still have my desire. We're multifaceted beings. I am rational and logical, but I'm also deeply emotional. I'm creative, and I'm incredibly, deeply analytical. One thing doesn't cancel out the other unless you've not examined your emotional source code, and then you have an identity. You say, well, this is what I am. No, you're not.
I have so much... to start again.
Sorry, I just blew your brains out.
Well, look, so I buy this deeply, and there is this, you know, started my career as a soldier, left through an unfortunate circumstance, ended up in a corporate career, then started building companies. I'm 7 companies in. I love what I do. And there is something really fascinating about when engaging with somebody, me having a desperate desire to want to know that multifaceted nature of the person I'm sitting across the table from, because it cannot be true that you are just A or you are just B or the way you describe or have that identity. And in the context of trying to forge relationships and trust and finding a way forward with people, it would be such a relief for them to say or find a way to express, here are the facets that you should be aware of about me so that we can find what the common ground is. It's, Dov, that's just fascinating to me.
Can I give you another example?
Sure.
Because I've done some work with, I've done a lot of work with vets. Okay. And one of my friends is one of the leading scientists who's treating them through vagal nerve injections and doing all kinds of amazing work. And he was having some challenges with some of the people. He was helping like massive amounts. He worked with the Green Berets. He works with all the special forces. But he was having some problems, and him and I talked about it. And I said, I know what the problem is. And he said, what? And I said, it's on a couple of levels, but first of all, it's this is, and this is very controversial, so please forgive me. I'm not trying to be controversial, it just is controversial, and that's this. Nobody's ever had PTSD who didn't have PTSD. And people go, what do you mean?
Mm.
If you've got PTSD from a battle, that's very real. But you had PTSD before you got PTSD. And people go, what do you mean? You had a mechanism, like I did, to repress, deny, compartmentalize the PTSD you had from other events, i.e. in childhood. And the war, the battle, has catalyzed that being seen in your own life, in your own being. But here's the deal, and this is, again, controversial. You don't sign up to kill foreigners unless you've got some shit to deal with. Right? Now, I know that not everybody goes into it that, but the mechanism is designed, that patriotism is designed that way. It's designed to pull into your weaknesses. It's designed to pull into your wounds. The mechanism of patriotism is specifically, psychologically designed to tap into those issues. Come with us, belong, be part of this, blah, 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 right? It's a tribal mentality. And of course, it's wonderful for that. And by the way, I am not, like I serve many high profile senior military people. So it's not that I'm against these people at all. I serve them. But I want them to understand you got into this for a reason, and the PTSD is a result of something that has not been addressed. When you address that, so my friend who treats these guys, I said, the problem is you're treating the PTSD for the event rather than treating root cause. If you don't go to root cause, it will just find a new way out. It'll find a new way to surface. And I know that's controversial. I know that's edgy, and I'm not trying to do it to be provocative. I'm trying to do it because here's the deal. As you walk down the street, you as in me, as in all of us, there are people we will judge. We see the guy with the needle in his arm, or we see the person who looks like the hooker or whatever it is. But here's what I want you to know. Everybody you meet is in pain. And everybody you meet is trying to feel better. Mm. You, me, every one of us. We're all trying to feel better. Some of us do it by sticking a needle in our arm and saying, you know, I sat in the back alley with some homeless people and watch them as they shut up and talk to them. I said, you know, this shit will kill you, right? And they go, and this guy says to me, I'm not a fucking idiot. Of course I know that.
Mm.
I just can't bear the pain. I can't bear the pain. Everybody is in pain and everybody's trying to feel better. Well, how are you trying to feel better? Well, sometimes you get to feel a lot better by having a gang of brothers who are your side by side, die in the ditch together, that you'll go to battle with.
Mm.
Sometimes it's sticking a needle in your arm, and sometimes it's standing on a stage and getting 10,000 people to applaud you.
Mm.
Is one better than the other? Not in my mind.
I don't disagree with you. There's a lot that we should have more conversations on to work that through. Let me take that source code example one step further.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you engage, when any organizational leader engages with another, the intention often is to find a way to do something better. At least that's what I hope the intention is. And they will spend a lot of time dancing around the idea of, unless they get one-on-one time together, they'll spend a lot of time dancing around their organizations. How is it that we can work together? How do we make things work to be more effective, bigger, stronger, etc.? If you were standing between two organizations who have instinctively determined that there is use in coming together. How do you collapse the time for them to understand each other so that they can have that conversation?
I give them in a room. And this is the primaries, right? So whoever's really going to be making the decisions, get them in the room and get them, I walk them through finding their own emotional source code and then finding the overlap with the other. Once you find that overlap, it's like, it's a done deal. Mm. It's like, oh, okay.
How long would that take? Generally speaking.
Well, I do it. So we do the initial work in, with an individual, it's a 24-hour straight.
Mm-hmm.
And when I say a 24-hour straight, I mean it's straight. So they start at 8 o'clock in the morning, they finish 8 o'clock in the morning, and there's no nap. So we work right through the night together with an individual. And then I work with them for 1 year afterwards.
Right.
To help them integrate their emotional source code in a way that is empowering. When we do it in a partnership or bringing companies together, and often I've been brought in to do it with a CEO or a leader that I've worked with, and they're bringing on somebody who's going to take up a very major role. They were, you know, we got to make sure this person looks great on paper, but we got to make sure there's a match. And then I interview them to see whether they can do this work, because I might say to them, this person can't do this work, so you're going to have problems. So you can take them on. They meet all the criteria, but I guarantee you're going to have problems. And every time that's gone against, they've gone against me, and sometimes with very good reasons, great resumes, it's come and bit them in the ass.
Yeah.
But when it's two companies coming together, we take those two leaders, we put them together, and we usually spend about 3 days together, 3 to 4 days together.
Right.
So we'll do the emotional source code of one person with the other person observing the first part of that. Then we switch and go to the other person, and we go backwards and forwards until we've nailed down pretty much the generalized emotional source code of both individuals. Then when we do is the third day, as we put those together, where is the common ground and what is the common purpose? Not the Simon Sinek start with why, but the why of the why, the underneath, what's underneath that. That comes together. And I've never found that it didn't. I can always find something that does. And so when I do it even with an executive team, because we do it with teams too, where you've got 5, 6, or even as many as 10 people together, we find that common thread. And that common thread is then what bonds them. And that's the driver that says, well, this is why we're doing this. So I say is, if you get those people in the room, even if one of them's kind of like annoying as all hell, but they understand their emotional source code together and they've tied together through a common why within the why, a purpose, then they're like, listen, you're really getting on my tits, but I know what matters is this to you. And they go, yep. Mm-hmm. And you go, okay, then we can find a way to do this.
Yeah.
Because that meaning, that purpose is more powerful, more important than my personality issues with you.
Mm. What's the exemplar of a partnership that sticks in your mind as being best in class as a consequence of that kind of work?
Well, that's very simple. That's Gorbachev and Reagan. That is, you know, because I'm old enough to remember the coming down of the wall in East Berlin, that was a really great example of people coming together. I remember I lived in Australia at that time. I was living in Perth. And I remember hearing about that. I followed global politics since I was a kid. So I was very interested in that. And little secret, that night I was out with my mates at the Red Parrot, which was a club in Perth that had recently opened. And I was off my tits on MDMA. I was on ecstasy. I was on the drug ecstasy. I never had the drug before. And somebody gave it to me. And I remember saying, oh my God, they should put this in the water for Reagan and Gorbachev. Because I'm a researcher, I understand that drug was designed in the early part of like 1906 or something like that, the original drug. And it was designed as a truth serum for military use.
Mm.
And the original name for it, when they discovered what it is that the original name was empathy. It brings up empathy. It's not ecstasy. It's not about shagging all night or partying like a lunatic. It was actually about building deep empathy with another person.
Yeah.
And you suddenly had deep empathy. And the interesting thing is this, that when it comes to partnerships, there's a lie you've been told. And this is really appropriate for your show. There's a lie you've been told. It's the same lie you were told about partnerships at a romantic level. That if you're going to make this relationship work, you will have to compromise. Lie, lie, lie. I want you to do something for me. I want you to go to, you can use an online dictionary, but go to a dictionary and look up the word compromise. It means to weaken. If you get a message over the radio and it says, oh, XYZ bridge, there's a turnoff and you can't go on the bridge, it's been compromised, you go, well, that's good then, right? No. You go, oh, I'm not going across the bridge, I might end up in the ocean. Right? So this is the thing. Compromise means to weaken. We don't want to compromise. We want to cooperate based on understanding the emotional source code of the other. How can I work with you? How can I co-promise rather than compromise? I don't want to weaken this. I don't compromise in my relationship with my wife. She doesn't compromise with me. I don't want that. I want to find a way for us to work together to make something stronger, to build up greater bond. And that is in many ways what happened with Gorbachev and Reagan. It wasn't a compromise. Neither of those guys were very good at compromising, and that was a good thing. They were looking at how can we come together. And that created the Minsk Agreement, which has caused the problems. The breaking of the Minsk Agreement is causing the problems that we have in the Ukraine today. And if you don't know what that means, go look it up. Do the research. It's worth it. Because that is, they've compromised the Minsk Agreement. And that's why you've got the problems you've got in the East right now.
Dov, where do people go to learn more about this work so that they can start to delve into it? Because you've touched on a bunch of different and very important insights through this. Where are we sending people? We'll put this in the show notes as well.
Thank you for asking, Phil. I appreciate it. You can go to dovbaron.com, as I said, dovbaron.com. And you can, as I said, if you just click anywhere in there, a red box will pop up and you can get the emotional source code of Vladimir Putin and a whole series of emails that will sort of walk you through it. So that's one way. I write for Entrepreneur Magazine. I write for Medium under Curious Leader. I have Curious Chronicles on dovbaron.com, which is a bunch of articles. I have a bunch of books. And, of course, I have my podcast, The Dov Baron Show, in which I go into a lot of these things, coming at it from a leadership position and understanding how it works, how it plays out. And that, because I'm a polymath, it goes into things like this week's releases on quantum biology. So, like, how we are impacting each other at a quantum level. Because here's the thing, as I said, you're not one facet. You're part of, you're multifaceted, but you're also part of a collective. And the collective is not just your tribe. You're part of the collective of humanity. And so once you understand that, you can understand that you can be reactive to everything that's going around you or impacting you, or you can choose to stand steady in the truth of who you are at a multifaceted, magnificent level. DovBaron.com. You can also find my podcast, The Dov Baron Show, easy to find. I have a YouTube channel that's got like 4,000 videos on it. It's also under my name. I'm on Twitter. And the easiest place to find me is, of course, on LinkedIn, where I also write a newsletter every Tuesday.
We're going to link to all of these things. Thank you for sharing that. And I think there is a lot to dive into. I'd like to have a follow-up conversation with you if that's okay with you.
Absolutely.
What are leaders today missing about the potent potential of partnering together?
I think that what they're missing is there's a lot in there. So I think they're missing the understanding that we come together for healing and growth. So, yes, there is economics, of course. But if I stop and go, hold on a second, I'm with this person because there's something here for me that has got nothing to do with money, then what is it? Because now I want to do business with you because there's all kinds of great things that are going to happen as a result. So, yeah, I want to do that. I want to find a way to come together. And what that requires is, again, reciprocal vulnerability. And I think most people are missing that when they look at a partnership. They don't think about how can I really show up? And by the way, lead the way. What I mean by that is don't wait for them to be vulnerable so you can be vulnerable. Lead the way. Because if you, and let me be clear, vulnerability is not pissing, moaning, whining, and complaining. That's pissing, moaning, whining, and complaining. Vulnerability is not that, right? If you think vulnerability is, no, that's not vulnerability. That's just whining. Vulnerability is sharing what you struggled with, struggle, and how you have dealt with that. Sharing what you are struggling with, how you're dealing with it, and sharing what you're struggling with that you don't know how to deal with, but you're looking for answers in, that's real vulnerability, right? Sharing that builds the trust that the other person goes, I trust this bloke, I this person, I really want to do something with them, because then they're jumping on a call with you because they want to have a conversation with you, and the business is a natural evolution of that.
That is a great answer. I hope everyone takes that to heart. Now, I've got five rapid-fire questions I'd like to close out with.
Please.
And I do feel as though this is going to be the first of a few conversations. So, first question, Dove, complete this sentence. Partnership is?
Relationship.
What content are you loving at the moment?
Oh, content. I love independent journalism.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really where I go. When people ask me, how do you know so much about world politics? It's because I listen to so many. I listen to Al Jazeera, BBC, Fox News, CNN, things that contradict each other on purpose. And then I have several independent journalists that I follow. And I just love people who can think outside of the box or think outside of the constraints of what is popular. I love that stuff. It feeds me.
I love that. What's the worst piece of advice you received and why?
Oh, that's easy. Get a job with a pension, lad. My first major relationship, her dad, I said, I'm thinking about starting a business. I was 16. And he goes, what are you bloody talking about? Get yourself a decent job with a pension. Right? You got to take care of your family. And I was like, oh, yeah, you're right. And I just felt completely depleted. Mm. And then about 2 days later, I'm in the shower. And I thought, his name was Jack. And I thought, do I want Jack's life?
Mm.
Jack was drinking his home-brewed beer, watching the telly in his council house. And I'm like, I don't want that fucking life. So why would I take his advice? Again, I needed a dad, and I went to that dad, and it was a shit advice, and I realized that's not who I am.
I get it. Now, tell me, when you see potential for a new partnership, how do you turn that potential into action? What's the first thing you do?
As I said before, I ask that person, what do you see?
Hmm.
What is it that you see? How can we come together in a way that will add value? Not just to you, not just to me, but to another. It's got to meet that. So I want to know, what is the budget of time? How long will it take?
Mm-hmm.
What is the budget financially? What is the budget of Dove time? Because that's the most valuable one for me.
Yep.
So I've got those three budgets. And then the fourth one is, how will this benefit the other? Not you, not me. So how are we going to make the world just a little bit better with this?
Hmm.
Not by selling them the new shiny object. How will it make the world a little bit better? If we can meet those four budgets, we got a relationship. We got a partnership.
I love it. Final one. What's one thing you're deeply grateful for right now?
Oh, that's easy. My grandkids. I have six grandkids. The youngest are 2 and 4. And they are with us every other weekend, and they I was talking to my wife last night, and I said, they are oxytocin manufacturing machines. They create the neurochemistry of love and bonding with them, where the things they're doing, we were saying last night, is they probably won't even remember fake reading. Like one of them sits in bed and she fake reads her book. She's four, and she wants to read a story before she goes to sleep, and she fake reads. She can't read. She fake reads, and it's like, oh my God, that's so beautiful.
It is.
I'm gonna miss that when that's gone.
Oh, look, we have two daughters at the moment. They're 9 and 12, and we snapped a video of the eldest one fake reading to the youngest one when they were very, very young. And it is, to date, one of my favorite videos of all time.
Oh, yeah.
It's spectacular.
Like, yeah, I am the Grinch whose heart is swelling. It's just like, oh, my God, this is so beautiful. So that's so definitely what I'm most grateful for. And if I may say another, it's that I was somehow smart enough to ask my wife to marry me. I don't know how it was, because I sure did, in the early days, did things to push her away, but the best decision I ever made was asking her to marry me, and the greatest gift is she said yes. She's the greatest thing that ever happened to me. She's an amazing human being. We've been together like 28 years, and she's just magnificent. She makes me, I mean, there's that bullshit thing, you make me a better man, but that's part of our agreement, that we call each other out to be the better human being. Not to be who I think she should be, or for her, me to be who she thinks I should be, but to be the better person that we want to be. That's the greatest gift.
We also share that in common. Dov, it has been spectacular talking to you. Thank you so much for the time, and I'm looking forward to the next one.
Thank you, sir. It's been a pleasure and honor. I really do appreciate you taking the time, and thank you for having me on. And if there's anybody I can be of service to, please feel free to reach out. You can actually reach out through all the places I said, but you can also write to me directly, dov@dovbaron.com. I know it's insane, but I do it. And the other thing I want you to do is this, before we go. I want you to do one thing for me. I want you to go to wherever you're listening this podcast from. I want you to rate it, and I want you to review it, because I know what it takes to put a show together, because I have a podcast. I've had one for 15 years. Rate, review, subscribe to the show, and let so that Phil knows. Otherwise, it's a one-way street where you're entitled. Write that you enjoy it and share it with somebody else. If you got something out of this, write to me. Tell me what you got out of it. Write to Phil. Tell him what you got out of it. Write it in the review. Share it with somebody else, because I guarantee you know, as you were listening to this, oh my God, I know somebody who should have heard that bit. Even if it was just for 2 minutes, send it to them. Share it with them. Let this man know that all the time and energy and effort that he puts in is worthwhile. I mean that.
Love it. Thank you, mate. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Before you go, I have a question for you. Do you worry that you're wasting time, money, and credibility on the wrong partnerships? It can be exhausting to pretend everything's fine while quietly second-guessing your decisions. You see others thriving with the right connections, and you're stuck wondering if you're missing out on opportunities to elevate your business and reputation. That fear of making another costly mistake can feel paralyzing. But the good news is that we can remove that right now. I've created a free online partner calculator to help you instantly assess if a potential partner is an ideal fit for your business. This tool, which comes with a case study about Tesla and Toyota, is designed to help you get clarity, confidence, and the edge you've been looking for to secure partnerships that not only work, but help you finally grow your business. The link to access this tool is in the show notes. I hope you've enjoyed today's episode. I'm Phil Hayes Sinclair. I'll see you in the next one.